like a word.
About men writing from a woman's perspective. You're listening to Weed Like a Word with me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colgan.
And we have RJ McBrien on the podcast, this time author of Reckless, and Shelley Weiner, who has written loads of books. I'm going to list some of them. I've got them written down because there's so many. Writing Short Stories, an instruction book, a guide. Writing Your First Novel. The Audacious Mendacity of Lily Green. Arnost, The Joker. The Last Honeymoon, A Cyst Tale. And she also is one of the tutors at the renowned Faber Academy, where writers go to hone their craft, including RJ McBrien. And we've been referring to RJ by initials so far, because that is one of those classic things that writers do to disguise whether they are a man or a woman. So we will now say, hello, RJ.
Hello, I turn out to be a man. How embarrassing.
RJ, or should we say Richard?
Richard, I think, yes, right. I think so.
And hello, Shelley.
Hi, I'm definitely not a man, although one can't say these things these days.
Ah, another strand of discussion.
Absolutely.
I suppose we should start before we get into the main topic. Richard, your book is about to come out?
Yes, on the 22nd of July.
So tell us about it.
I would say it's in the genre of a psychological thriller. I was trying to aim for things like Gone Girl and Girl on a Train. It's in that sort of world. And it's about a woman who has a happy marriage and a daughter that she gets on well with. And everything seems fine, apart from the fact that she doesn't have enough sex. She wants to address that issue, but she doesn't want to destroy her marriage. And through a friend or somebody she meets, an old friend, she is introduced to an agency that helps people in her position. In other words, people who wish to maintain their own marriage, but nevertheless have an affair on the side, which is entirely physical and nothing else. And so she signs up for this, and at the beginning all goes well. And then it all starts to go horribly wrong. And that is the twists and turns of the book. So it's about somebody taking what she thinks is a fairly reasonable step, but then it becoming more and more convoluted and more dangerous. And that's why I call her sort of reckless, because she sort of steps over the edge and then is in free fall and has to try and cope. So that's the sort of territory of it.
As a male writer, I listened to that description of it, and I thought, what on earth made you decide to do it? Because it seems such a big step to take for a man to write a book like that, because, you know, there's 51% of the population out there who are going to pick you up on everything you get wrong.
Yes. I only realized that once I started, whether that would be that has been a worry. I mean, I had this idea because somebody sent me an article in a magazine, which was about a real agency set up in this way. It was an interview with about four people, one of whom was the guy who set it up, and then three people who had used the services of this particular agency. And at that time, I thought it would make a good film. And I wanted to write it from the male point of view. But then it actually turned out, when I thought about it, it turned out to be rather sleazy from if you write it from the male point of view, and much more interesting to write it from the woman's point of view. And then when I signed up to do Shelley's Faber writing course, because I'm a first-time novelist, I hadn't tried this before, I went back to this idea and thought, I didn't really think through how tricky it might be. So I started from the woman's point of view, and then had quite a lot of help from women on the course and Shelley herself, who did keep saying, well, women wouldn't think that, wouldn't say that, wouldn't dress like that, all sorts of things. So I had quite a lot of help of tweaking it as I went along. But I didn't quite realise what I'd taken on until it was too late.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky thing. I mean, I've written books with quite strong female main characters. And it's always been a revelation to me when I've passed it out. I've got a lovely little group of critical readers who basically I can give my first draft to, and they will rip it up for toilet paper, but in a kind, friendly way, as if to say, you've really got to fix this bit, Steve. And sure enough, by the time I get to the stage of actually putting it through, you know, my publisher puts it through the editor, there's very rarely any edits that are needed.
Yes.
But it's they're about 50-50 men and women, and it's proved invaluable. But I don't know whether I'd be brave enough to write one from a woman's perspective. That's quite a bold move, and I can't think of many books that have done that written by men.
Oh dear. Well, I don't know. I sort of, once I got going, at the beginning it was more difficult because trying to get into her voice, into her head. But as I went along, I found it easier. But I too had the great advantage of a little group, which were people who had been on this course with whom I stayed in touch. And I agree with you. I sent it out to them the whole time and they sent back quite critical, but very useful edits. And those were nearly all women. I think there were six women and two men. So they were quite critical. Yeah, and they were very helpful. And then I used to just go back and, you know, redo it. And the way that we had done the course was we would do a certain number, 70,000 words a week and criticize each other's efforts. So I was doing it, we continued that. And so I was doing it sort of piecemeal. So I would send them some stuff and then they'd say, well, that doesn't work. And then I'd spend 2 weeks rewriting it. And once that had happened a few times, I sort of got into, I found I could hear her voice, I hope. So that was the process, rather than writing it all and then sending them the whole thing. I think that was the trick for me. Have those problems addressed as I went along.
We have had other guests on We'd Like a Word who write books from women's perspectives, like Adrian McKinty with The Chain, hugely successful, and Brian McGilloway, who I like to go on about every now and then. What a lovely voice he has. Also good books. And his Lucy Black series, who's a police officer in Derry in Northern Ireland. But you're taking on a particularly, I suppose, difficult aspect of life, as in, you know, intimate sexual relations and marriage. It's not adventure. I mean, there is adventure and threat and treachery and the police are involved. But I wonder, Shelley, in your capacity as guide to Richard through this, or guide of all the guides, what are the kind of mistakes that men tend to make that let them down?
Well, I think before we start talking about mistakes, I think the overall idea of writing fiction and characterizing your protagonist, but all your characters, is the challenge of inhabiting the soul of your character, empathy, understanding. And I think another changing gender, writing across gender, is just another challenge. It may be harder because it calls for research and humility, but above all, it's a leap of imagination that we all take, whatever we're writing, whether we're writing old, young, across gender, across race, across culture. I believe that this is the important thing. If you create a character with integrity, and I really think that Richard's character, Kristen, really works as a woman, as a person. He's obviously thought her through, and I think it's very significant when he said a minute ago how he gradually heard her voice. This was the leap. I mean, he has some great predecessors, not to mention Anna Karenina, Madame Bovary. I mean, it's not a new thing. As you say, Paul, there are many who do it. And it is a challenge. And I think particularly focusing on her sexuality makes it even, does feel a greater challenge. But it's all part of her whole. And I think that he's gone beyond just, even though his character is looking for sex without ties, I think she works as a character. You know that there's something she wants in her life, which is essential, beyond this kind of thing that she buys. For 1,500 guineas, I love that. I love the use of guineas.
It's not something you hear anymore, is it? Except in horse races.
And some private doctors charge in guineas.
Do they still charge in guineas? That's extraordinary.
They still charge in guineas, like Harley Street doctors, some of them old-fashioned ones. It's so bizarre.
Yeah. Well, it was always the way, wasn't it, that the doctor would get the pound and their assistant would get the shilling. That was the whole point of charging a guinea. Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that.
I'm just imagining somebody turning up with a bag of guinea pigs by mistake.
No, I was having this discussion with someone the other day about, of all weird things, Wallace and Gromit, and saying it's quite weird that when you watch Wallace and Gromit, you know, the films are marvellous, and yet they're actually... It's like watching an animated evening comedy, because if you look at all the signs on the shops and things, they're all in pounds, shillings and pence. Yes. And when my grandchildren are watching it and they're saying, what does that mean? I said, well, that means it's 10 and 6. Oh, no, you wouldn't know what 10 and 6 is, would you? That's 52 and a half p. They go, what?
I was talking to somebody else about this the other day and saying I remembered a farthing.
Yeah.
I mean, that is extraordinarily odd thought. Anyway.
How can you remember a farthing? I can see you on screen here and you don't look like you could remember a farthing.
I do remember a farthing. I do.
I remember them. I never used them because they went out of circulation the year I was born. But there were always farthings around the house. So you were digging them up in the garden and things like that. So and there was always a little picture of the wren on them. And yes. So I remember them quite well. He's obviously found them on an archaeological dig, you know, sometime long before he was born.
Yes. Getting back to books. So, Shelley, as you put it, all writing is a leap of imagination. So I guess this is no different. But what should male writers keep in mind particularly? Or how do you think men tend to see things differently from women in a way that they might have to get out of when they're writing?
Beyond saying, don't all individuals see things according to their unique perception, who they are, where they come from. I think we're all originals and every character is original, but that may be ducking the question. I've got a lovely quote here. Jack Nicholson played a misanthropic author in As Good As It Gets. Do you remember it?
Yeah.
And he was asked how he writes women so well, the author, his character. And he said, I think of a man and I take away the reason and the accountability. I thought that was a really good quote. It's, you know.
That's quite risky.
Yeah. How does that strike you, Richard?
Well, I
think carefully how you answer.
Yeah, I don't think that's necessarily true.
But Nicholson gets away with it. I don't know if any of us could.
But I think that the things that I got picked up on was I didn't have enough description of how she looked. Because, and I found that difficult, because it's from the first person's point of view, and therefore she didn't necessarily describe herself. Whereas in what I've done before, film and television, it's quite easy, because obviously the camera sees the person the whole time. What I had missed out was what she looked like and how she felt about the way that she looked. Those are things that people, a lot of my helpers pointed out. And then I had to think of a way to allow her to be seen without making it clumsy, if you see what I mean. She can use a certain number of mirrors, you know, she can look at herself. She can look at herself through other people's eyes, which was quite helpful. So through her daughter's eyes, through her lover's eyes, through her husband's eyes. And that, once I'd gone through, I literally went through and tried to find places to do that so that the reader had a visual idea of her. But I had started off writing it, I didn't have that. I didn't have that at all. I didn't have anything about her hair, her dress, her clothes, all that I was helped with. You know, those are the things that I had skipped over.
You do capture, which is quite familiar, you know, the sense women are bothered, certainly middle-aged women are bothered about the way they look. And they also have a certain amount of body dysmorphia, you know. She feels horrible, she feels lumpy, and I feel, you know, you captured that. And yet, according to the eyes of her lover, who may also not be very reliable after all, you know, he's in it too, he finds her beautiful. So there is that contradiction, which is great.
It's another sort of dangerous area, isn't it, to write about, particularly as a man, because this is such a hot potato about women's expectation of how they should look, a lot of which is dictated by men, of course, and by fashion magazines and things like that. And women saying, you know, we shouldn't be judged for our bodies and how we look and how we dress and that sort of thing. It's a very tricky thing then to write a character who cares about those things without making it look as if you're sort of adding another level to the misogyny. It's very tricky. Yeah. You're a brave man. You're a brave man, Richard.
Who knows whether I'm going to get a whole dumped on. But I thought I wanted to make her, in her own mind, be less attractive than she really was. So that I wanted to set it up that actually her lover did find her attractive. And then she becomes more attractive in her own eyes, I suppose. I was interested in how people see themselves because they imagine how other people see themselves. So she thinks that her husband sees her as dumpy middle-aged woman or whatever. And then when she meets her lover, she then sees herself through his eyes, if you see what I mean. So I tried to put that in. And at the beginning, I have her, when she's very young, she has a drawing by a friend artist of her. And she's able to see herself as he saw her, which was more attractive than she thought she was. So I'm quite interested in the idea of how you think about yourself until you can imagine yourself being seen through somebody else's eyes. That was the area I was interested in. Whether that works or not, I don't know. But that was I thought that's quite interesting.
Yeah, and all the thought you give that as you describe it, I think gives a hint to the depth that you've given to this, that you weren't writing a sort of, you know, a thriller on the surface. I think that you took all my lessons of going in deep, staying in your story really seriously.
Can we hear some of it?
Yes. Well, oh goodness, how embarrassing is that? So what I thought
this is going to be even better, as well as writing from a woman's perspective. Maybe you're going to be being a woman, embodying the woman in your speech now.
Yeah. It's a little tiny bit. I can't put on the voice, obviously. So first time that she meets her lover, who she's never met before, and the arrangement is that you meet the person in a public place, and then you go to a secure room in a sort of serviced flat, which you've checked out before, where you can, you know, get down to it. But she's only met this guy for 10 minutes. So I'm going to pick up the story here where they go into the flat together, and this is the first moment they're alone, and they both know what's coming, if you see what I mean. So I say this, okay, shall I start? So the curtains were half drawn, subtle lights bathing everything in a forgiving yellow glow. Ambient music played softly from hidden speakers. The bed, puffed with cushions, stood like a sporting arena awaiting a great contest. I glanced at the bathroom. I should, absolutely. Easing the bolt across, I caught sight of myself in the long mirror, then quickly looked away before I lost what little confidence I had. Sitting to pee, my left foot began jigging up and down like a nervous five-year-old's. I squished my other foot on top of it. My stomach was still wobbly with nerves. Maybe I should be taking off my clothes, ready to stride in, grab him by the lapels and pull in close. I felt nauseous. There must be a minibar. Maybe we should start with that. I slid back the bolt. As my eyes adjusted to the gloom of the bedroom, I saw Thomas standing by the window, naked, feet astride, hands on hips. What did he expect me to do? Applaud? Hold up a card with a 9 on it? Though an 11 might have been more appropriate. No wonder the guy was confident. Say hello to Toby. I found myself suppressing a giggle, tried to turn it into a cough, and ended up making a peculiar spluh sound. Perhaps if I'd laughed it off, grinned, and if he'd laughed it off and grinned and thrown me onto the bed, everything would have been fine. Instead, he stared at me as if I'd farted in a communion service. Sorry, I said. Sorry, should I take off my... He put his fingers to his lips. Shh. He took a couple of steps, his ball swaying like an abbreviated Newton's cradle. I noticed his pubes were darker than his hair. Could he have dyed them? What sort of man does that? As he reached for the buttons on my blouse, I could feel Toby poking me in the tummy. The laughter began to rise again, undeniable, irrepressible. I clamped my mouth shut. What the hell was wrong with me? I turned away, our heads bumped. I could see his willy waggling about like one of those balloon sculptures at a kid's party. I laughed out loud, a proper loud, full-on laugh. What the fuck, he said. Any residual magic vanished like a bubble popping in a bath. 2 minutes later, I was back on the street, blinking in the afternoon sunshine. Hurrying to the tube, I didn't dare look back, convinced he'd be loping down the street after me like an irate silverback. So that's her first encounter with this guy. Not the eventual guy, but the first guy.
Yeah. When you said the bit you were going to read, having read the book, I was chuckling to myself, and I'm chuckling now. Because we didn't mention that it is actually very funny as well, in parts.
That's true. Yeah, it is.
It's interesting because I was particularly listening because I'm a big fan of the Bad Sex Awards every year. And they're always written by men, and because men are just terrible at writing it. But I was listening to that and thinking, that's not going to appear. It's okay. It's funny and it's witty and it's clever and it hasn't got any of those horrible cliches and similes that men seem prone to use and, you know, breasts that pulse with resentment and things like this. It was actually very good.
Well, I think it's very difficult to write a good serious sex scene.
So obviously, so
I've got a comedy one, but quite easy to write a terrible sex scene. I wanted to try and avoid that, and I'm not sure that women think about it in that way. It was my guess. I think that it's more interesting why she does what she's going to do and then the consequences of it afterwards, rather than going into the description of actually what happens. We can pretty much guess what happens. So I tried to avoid too many obvious sex scenes, too many explicit sex scenes, although she does think about it a lot. But she doesn't, as you say, doesn't go into the all into the, you know, sweaty details.
Yeah, and there was quite a lot of detail there.
There was quite a bit of detail.
Well, Len always obsessed with the anatomy of it all, and usually get it wrong.
I couldn't possibly write about the real experience because that really would have been very, what right have I to do that? I did know somebody, a friend who was a woman who was approached by a man who insisted on him, be calling his Willy Toby, and as if it was a separate person. I thought that was quite funny.
I'm just going to look to see who you've dedicated this book to. It's not,
Not
Toby or in the acknowledgements.
To my wife and daughter who I dedicated my book to, not to Toby, my good friend.
Yeah, okay. On that happy note, this could be the end of part one. And in part two, we'll be delving into the interesting backstories of both of you. So for the moment, you're listening to Weed Like a Word with me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colgan.
And we've got Shelley Weiner and RJ, or as we have now revealed, Richard McBrien, author of Reckless. And join us in part two.